that important that can't wait. It's unbelievable. I like turning all that stuff off. That's why I like being on planes. No one can get a hold of me. What are you doing, Matt? Is that your cell phone? Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine. Okay. Does anyone have any questions about anything before I just give a few brief announcements and turn the floor over to Dr. Hamilton, who I've already introduced to you, but I will introduce him again in about a second. Nick, you want to take your seat? So there's a couple things I just want to share with you. I may change the date of the take-home exam going out and coming in. You'll have exactly the same amount of time. I'm not going to change anything. About one lecture behind. And I was going to hand out the take-home exam on Tuesday, but I may wait till the following Tuesday just so I can cover a little bit more things that you'll need for the take-home exam, namely intellectual property and regulating science and stuff like that. Haven't completely made up my mind yet. But if I decide to do this, the take-home exam will go out on Valentine's Day. It'll come back 2 weeks later, and you'll have your midterm oral on the 28th. And I hope that doesn't present any problems. And if it does, please let me know. Don't forget, on Tuesday, Harry Klan's going to be here, another speaker, and he's going to be talking about DNA testing in the law. And so keep that in mind, and there'll be the reception on the patio and then dinner with me, and please RSVP with Jessica. Today we have Richard. Richard's going to have to run, as I told you, on Tuesday. He'll stay for a few minutes for the reception so that you can ask a few questions, but then he's going to go on to more important things, and I'm going to go to dinner with you guys. And speaking of which, Jessica's the answer yes or no? The answer's yes? Oh, all right. I was going to offer my basketball tickets, but Jessica grabbed them first. So there you go. I'll give you another chance. I have season passes to the Bruins, but I never go. So if anybody wants to go, I already gave those tickets away. I had four tickets to the Arizona game. It's my alma mater, but I can't go because I have a National Academy of Sciences meeting in Irvine this weekend. Okay, I'm going to come back to that in a second. Now, when you leave today, Sam was frothing at the mouth in discussion yesterday about ethics and scientists and ethics and science and ethics and how come scientists don't do more and all that kind of stuff, which is kind of what we do with our life, Sam, which we'll talk about at dinner. But fact of the matter is that you will have some reading that you can look at. And there's a website called doegenomes.org. And I printed out some stuff from doegenomes.org, which has a lot of things dealing with the Human Genome Project, but has a lot of things dealing with DNA testing in the law, DNA testing in health insurance, DNA testing discrimination, has a lot of links, et cetera, et cetera. And so you'll have this handout when you leave. Please look it over. Second handout you'll have is the Genographic Project, which is to trace human origins and the origins of all the peoples on the face of this earth, sponsored by National Geographic. Gave you a handout with that. If you look at this website, David, you'll see that they use exactly the same kind of kit that you used in class on Tuesday to do DNA testing, and it's a fascinating little proposition. I printed out a summary of a workshop by the American Society of Law, Medicine, and Ethics, Sam, on DNA forensics and civil liberties, and it's just a summary of a bunch of cases that were presented, and that will be relevant too. And then there's some Scientific American articles which have just recently come out that are very timely and very relevant that you'll have. One is called The Land of Milk and Honey, and it's the first approval by the FDA of a drug made in a mammal, in this case a sheep, and it's an antithrombin drug, which means that it's the drug which is necessary to prevent your blood from clotting. And people who are genetically deficient in antithrombin, it can be a lethal disease because the blood automatically clots, you know, during the fetal stage. And so this is a big deal. Second thing is what you talked about in discussion yesterday, I think it was Samantha, talking about markers and mutations for genetic diseases arising independently in different families, which is true, but we also pointed out that sometimes the same mutation occurs in all families because it arose very, very, very long time ago and just stayed in that population. It's called founder mutations. And this is a very recent Scientific American article. It deals exactly with what you've been talking about in discussion, DNA testing and markers, only it shows some very, very, very spectacular examples of how these markers have arisen, like Tay-Sachs disease, and stayed in a high prevalence in certain populations, and it's the same mutation, and therefore you can use the same probe and the same marker. Then finally, for Tuesday, please read this other Scientific American article, brand new, called The Alternate Genome. And it really talks about how the human genome only has 30,000 genes, but yet you can make hundreds of thousands of proteins, and the involvement of introns and those kinds of after transcription process, which you had a little bit in discussion, not very much, but I'm going to talk a lot about on Tuesday. And so please pick up that stuff. And then the final thing I have to say is that next discussion is a break. There's no articles for discussion for next week. I did it on purpose. But there is a discussion, and we want you to go to discussion. As you know, it's a requirement. I will show two films in discussion. I should say Mike and Gloria will show two films, and they're really fascinating. Deal with DNA testing and the law. And this will prepare you, because the next discussion, 2 weeks from Wednesday, 3 weeks from yesterday, is in the law school. And that's where you have your moot court play, which I'll talk more about on Tuesday, where you're going to come in costumes and you're going to have a crime scene and you're going to act it out and you're going to tape it and it's going to be filmed and all of that. And so this will help prepare you along with Officer Harry Klan, who's going to be here next week. So that's what's in store and that's what's coming up and on the horizon. And it's almost hard to believe that, in fact, it's going to be the fifth week next week. It's hard to believe. Any questions about anything? And if not, I don't know why I'm turning all this stuff on, but Mike, if you could switch the computer over to Dr. Hamilton's computer, I would appreciate it. Now, I told you on Tuesday that there's no one that I can think of that knows more about how to start a biotechnology company than Dr. Richard Hamilton, who's a very close friend of mine and who I've known for now almost 10 years. And who has been involved in starting many, many biotech companies, but is very unique, as I told you on Tuesday, because he has a PhD in molecular biology. He's done postdoctoral work in cancer research and then went into the venture capital business and looked at many, many business plans and made recommendations and funding many biotech companies. And then he moved, as I told you, to a young startup plant genomics company called Cirrus. At the time, it was in Malibu. Now it's in Thousand Oaks. It's not so young anymore. It's 10 years. It's hard to believe, Richard, isn't it? 10 years. Remember when we were wandering through the halls of Paris? When was that? 1997, I think. In any case, Richard was the chief financial officer. And now that's interesting, a molecular biologist, a PhD with molecular biology, who's a chief financial officer, but now he's the chief executive officer of Cirrus, and he may tell you a little bit about it, but what Richard's going to talk about is how to make a biotech company. Where's your case study? So please take it out, and hopefully you've all looked at it. Brian, take out your case, and Charles, and T, you have yours, and good. So here's the format. Richard's going to talk for about an hour on how to make a biotech company. Feel free to interrupt him with questions if you want, and because you're going to hear things from a perspective you're not going to hear anywhere else except from Richard. And then afterwards, we'll take a 3.5 picosecond break. And then a picosecond is 10 to the minus 12 seconds. And then we're going to have a discussion. You're going to have a discussion with Richard leading it and me helping him on this case study. and that's how it's going to go. So let's give a very, very, very warm welcome to Dr. Richard Hamilton for coming here, because he had a really busy day, and we're really appreciative that he's here. Richard, the floor is yours.
Yeah, should be on now. My kids just watched the Star Wars movies for the first time, and now everything is a lightsaber. It's dangerous. Okay. Am I too close to Bob, or? Okay, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about how to start how biotechnology companies have been started, at least in the past. Not necessarily, the past is only an imperfect mirror of the future. So what I'm going to talk about is how people have done it over the past 20 years or so, and what some of the common themes are that emerge and the common challenges that they face. So one of the first questions I always like to ask is, why would you ever want to start a biotechnology company in the first place? Well, you guys have grown up in a time of where you see technological innovation all around you, from iPods to Google, and so you're probably used to the idea a little bit more than perhaps your parents or my parents were, in terms of companies being founded around technological innovations. But technological innovation can create, obviously, competitive advantage when it's properly protected. And when I say protected, I mean patent protected, right? The only protection you have as a small company is that patent, is that piece of paper that says, no, Mr. General Motors or Ford or IBM or whatever it is, you cannot practice my invention. And that's how small companies get themselves in business and stay in business. So it's really, really important. And if you think, forget about me, but if you think the United States is going to be, what do they call it, the knowledge economy, right, and compete not on the basis of cheap labor or natural resources, but on knowledge, we had better be protecting that knowledge, and you should be doing everything you can to encourage your elected representatives and the United States Patent Office to do that. There are other people who don't feel that way. So in biotechnology, the question was, well, what can we do sort of better, smarter, faster, cheaper? And the early days of recombinant DNA technology, I was in high school. Bob, you were probably a full professor by then, weren't you? But of course, back then people said, well, look, we can cut DNA and glue it back together, and well, what should we do with that? And one of the first things they said, well, we should make these drugs. And I remember there used to be something called the Guinness Book of World Records. You guys ever hear this? Guinness Book of World Records? Yes? No? Maybe? Okay, so, well, you've heard of Guinness, right? It's a beer. And the way the Guinness Book of World Records was, Irishmen like to sit around and have bar bets of, what was the largest acorn ever found or something. And that's, so this Guinness Book of World Records got founded. And at any rate, I remember reading an edition of it, and this would have been back in the 1970s, and the most valuable substance known to man in the Guinness Book of World Records was something called interferon A, right? It was a molecule that was thought to be useful. It's a protein. It's a human protein, and it was thought to be useful in cancer therapy, and it was the most valuable substance known to man because it took an enormous amount of work to be able to purify that from human blood. Right, and you get these minuscule quantities, And so along comes genetic engineering, and can we take that gene for human interferon, splice it into an appropriate host, and overproduce interferon? And the answer is yes, we can. And so people thought that these protein drugs would have lower toxicity because they're natural molecules. They would have superior what's called bioavailability, right? When you take a drug via orally or via an injection, it has to actually get to the site of action and work. And as a result, would have higher efficacy. Not all those things turned out. I'm going to talk about this concept a little bit today, technology push or market pull. It's not that there's a right or a wrong way, that you should always go after technology push or you should always go after market pull, but it's an interesting, prism with which to view emerging technologies and emerging companies. So as we said, back when Bob was already a full professor back in the 70s, you had these recombinant DNA technologies invented. Very important rulings, not only around DNA being patentable, right? So what the USPTO considers is that a DNA molecule is like any other chemical molecule, and just as I could patent a chemical compound that is a pharmaceutical, I can patent a chemical compound that is DNA, and I can describe that chemical structure in its DNA sequence. And so if I have this DNA sequence, I can submit that to the patent office, and as long as I claim a real-world utility, the courts will grant a patent on that. And it's been the foundation of the biotechnology industry. Without that kind of IP protection, you wouldn't have a biotechnology industry. The other thing that's neat about biotechnology is it's scalable, it's flexible, and it's enabling, right? When I say enabling, it means there really isn't another way to get to interferon A other than through genetic engineering, right? You're not going to make a business trying to purify it. So one of the big questions was really in the beginning, well, what should we make, right? When you go back to some of these pioneers in the early days, we're like, well, we didn't know what to make. Genentech actually got started doing a lot of work on somatostatin. Didn't turn out to be a commercial success. They quickly moved to insulin. And wound up doing a big deal with Eli Lilly to make insulin. And if anybody is a diabetic or knows a diabetic, some 95% of insulin is now genetically engineered Humulin, Humalog. It's human insulin. It's not from the pancreas of slaughtered animals. And interesting developments, Nectar, a friend of mine, Rob Chase, is the CEO of this company, Nectar Pharmaceuticals, just got their inhaled insulin approved by the FDA. Going to be marketed by Pfizer. So again, just some terminology. What is a biotechnology company? It's a phrase that gets bandied about a bit. Biotechnology company generally refers to any company using recombinant DNA technology, but especially in the financial community, it's considered any sort of small startup company that's pursuing drug discovery. It's something that I have a challenge with when I describe my own company, which is primarily involved in agriculture and energy. As opposed, we say, oh, we're a biotech company, and people say, well, what drug are you developing? Well, we're not. And, their eyes kind of roll back in their head, and they say, I don't know what to do with you. So what are the elements that are needed to start a biotechnology company? Well, you certainly need a market niche or a need. Now, in pharmaceuticals, that would seem kind of obvious, right? There's diseases, there's untreated medical conditions. And you don't need to necessarily go after the biggest ones, right? You can just focus on one thing and just do it very well. That's advice that I would give to any would-be entrepreneur in any industry. That brings up the second thing you need, which is an entrepreneur. And how many people read the case study? How many people want to go to Harvard Business School? Read the case studies. You'll be eviscerated if you don't. How many people want to be Joshua Crane, just out of curiosity? Nobody? One, maybe? Who's Joshua Crane? Didn't read the case study. Anybody? Nobody wants to be Joshua Crane? To be an entrepreneur like Joshua Crane. Start your own company. It's okay. No? There's one. Two? There's a girl. So you need an entrepreneur, and we'll go through some of the characteristics of entrepreneur. I'm surprised I don't see more hands in the air. Usually the United States is a pretty is a hotbed of entrepreneurialism. As a country and as a culture, it's a huge competitive advantage that we have. You need some technology, and we'll talk about how technology gets generated. But I'm going to talk about more about technology ownership and protection than anything else. And not surprisingly, you need money, capital. So I talked about this, but why did people focus on pharmaceutical discovery as one of the first applications of biotechnology? Well, it's relatively low volume and high value, right? If you think about the investments, the amount of money that you need to raise to do pharmaceuticals relative to some other things, the amount of what's called PP&E, or plant property and equipment, that you need is relatively low, right? Think of yourself as starting a car company or something, right? I mean, how are you going to do that, right? With a pharmaceutical company, you know, one manufacturing plant, you can pretty much cover the whole world. So pharmaceuticals in general tend to be a low volume, high value product, not a lot of infrastructure requirements. The trouble with pharmaceuticals, as we'll see, is they have very high regulatory requirements, right? There's a very high wall at the FDA that you need to jump over. Once you jump over that wall, it has been, up until recently, sort of a license to go print money. But nonetheless, those regulatory barriers exist. And there are other applications, such as agriculture, industrial, the things that my company, Ceres, is involved in. I really wasn't planning to talk about Ceres at all. I'm trying to keep this a little bit more abstract. I can come back another time and talk all day about Ceres. So what is it about entrepreneurs that are pretty unique? Well, clearly they're risk takers. I think what I like about entrepreneurs is that they pursue opportunity without regard to the resources they currently control. Okay, they don't sit there and say, oh God, you know, I've got just me and my buddy and we're working in our garage and we're going to take on IBM. Right? Steve Jobs did. Right? Bill Gates did. Those guys, I mean, conventional wisdom back then was that anybody was nuts to try and take on IBM. And now you guys are probably sitting there going, IB who? Right? Right? Compared to Microsoft or Apple, you guys don't consider it, right? So they have, again, I'm sort of reading these words, they see change or even challenges as an opportunity, right? And, you know, if there's a roadblock in the way, entrepreneurs typically see that as an opportunity because they know if they can be smart and figure out a way over that roadblock or around it, they're going to create a competitive advantage for themselves. And they can thrive in the right environment. And one of the right environments is referring back to what I was saying earlier about the United States. The United States has a wonderful environment for entrepreneurs. We have incredibly healthy capital markets, private equity capital markets, ability to go raise money to back entrepreneurs. We have professionals associated with entrepreneurial industries, lawyers, auditors, who are familiar with what is necessary to make startup companies a success. And you don't see this in a lot of other places. You certainly don't see it in a lot of places in Western Europe, which is why they have some pretty sclerotic GDP growth over the past decade or so. So technology, where does technology get generated for the most part? Anybody? Bueller? Come on, don't make me just stand up here and talk.
Come on, Samantha, where's technology generated?
It doesn't just come out of thin air.
You mean like in laboratories?
In laboratories. Where are laboratories?
In companies or in universities?
In universities. There you go. Well, in companies too, but generally speaking, those big companies, they want to own that, their own technology. So for a lot of entrepreneurs, sometimes a big company will say, well, here's a technology I'm not interested. You go on and take that. And probably the most famous example is Xerox. Right? You guys know what a GUI interface? You guys use that word anymore? Just GUI interface? Anybody know what a GUI interface is? You do, right? Graphical user interface. It's what we all use to interface with our computer. Once upon a time, like when I first started using computers, remember, everybody had to know MS-DOS, right? You had to just type in your own DOS commands. Yeah, get the frown. What? Huh? Huh? No mouse? Right? No icons? What's that? So Xerox actually developed that. And they said, well, geez, we can't use this in the photocopy business. And so they gave it away. They gave it away to Steve Jobs at Apple, which was the one of the things that, that really made Apple a success. So big companies sometimes generate technology, but by and large, you have this, again, in the right environment. In the United States, you have this wonderful federally supported university R&D system. And one of the most important things to impact that system, I'd say since World War II, has been the Bayh-Dole Act. Evan Bayh is a senator from Indiana. He's still in the Senate, isn't he? It's his son now. Jeez. Okay, and Bob Dole. And what this says, and we're going to get back to this when we talk about the case, is that, so UCLA, right, that guy right there, will get federal grant money from the government, from all of our tax dollars, and he'll invent something. He finds the Rumpelstiltskin gene that allows us to spin corn stover into gold, right? So Bob finds the Rumpelstiltskin gene. Who owns that? UCLA owns that. We'll talk about whether or not Bob should own that here in a minute. But one of the things Bob does, as I did when I work at, when I'm at Cira's and when I was a postdoc at Harvard, I sign away my intellectual property. It's part of my employment agreement. I say anything that I generate will belong to, in that case, Harvard and now Cira's, and I suspect Bob has done the same thing for UCLA. So the university owns it, but what the Bayh-Dole Act basically says is that the federal government does not. So even though the government funded the work, the government says, you, Mr. University, you own it, you go license it out to startup companies or do whatever you want with it. And so it's a great stimulus. The government retains some rights. They can use it for military applications or the case of national emergency. And I think the number of times that that's been exercised, I'm not aware of any in biotechnology. Are you, Bob? I can't think of any. And it's really important. And another important concept here to talk about when it comes to technology, and it'll come across as sort of counterintuitive to people, is this idea of private versus public ownership of technology. Okay? Some people say, well, you know, the university, UCLA, that's a, you know, that got funded with my tax dollars, and so the technology, we should just throw that out into the public, and anybody should be free to use it because everybody's tax dollars went in. And I got to tell you guys, that's the death knell for any technology. There isn't a venture capitalist in the world who's going to fund that because it serves no competitive advantage. If all my competitors can use it, why am I going to use it, right? Maybe if it's an enabling technology, but the whole purpose of intellectual property and what I call private ownership is to give people temporary monopolies, right? Some people who are opposed to this kind of thing view it as, well, it's a monopoly forever. No. A patent is a temporary monopoly, right? It allows you to hold aside the competition, develop the technology with the idea, and the quid pro quo is that someday that technology is going to go into the public domain. And then people are going to be able to build off of that and start other companies and do other things. Question, yeah.
So what happened if the public domain needs that?
Well, that's a loophole in the Bayh-Dole.
Before the patent time is over.
Well, it's, you know, if it, according to the government, if it's like a national emergency or something like that, the government has the right to just take it and use it.
Okay.
So, but you know, you have to define the word need, right? Do we really need, for example, Microsoft's technology so that we could just put Bill Gates out of business and have everybody's computers be free? Yeah. If it was something like bird flu vaccine or therapeutic, and the patent holders were unwilling to make a license available, the governments step in and just say, no, we're gonna take that. It's sort of like eminent domain when they're building a freeway and your house happens to be in the way. Too bad.
No. If it was funded by the federal government, not if it was funded by private equity to begin with. This is dealing only with federally funded research, like what we're doing in our lab.
So then you have some challenges to technology commercialization. Chances are when Bob discovers the Rumpelstiltskin gene, he doesn't quite get it to gold, right? Maybe he gets it to lead or something. But it's not quite all the way there. And you really, it's tough to recognize the potential of technology at an early stage. And you have these issues of technology push and market pull. We'll get to them. You certainly have regulatory hurdles, certainly in pharmaceuticals, as well as other aspects of biotechnology. Access to capital is always a challenge. Biotechnology has fallen in and out of favor with investors on multiple occasions. It's sort of like having gone through multiple dot-com booms and busts. And you need management teams. You need people who understand how to commercialize technology. And especially with new technology, that's not always the easiest thing to do. If you Google, they laughed at Einstein, you'll come up with a whole host of these examples. This is one of my favorite Western Union memo from 1876 saying, telephones, who needs them? Just stay out of telegraphy and we're good. And there's other ones. There's one in there from Bill Gates that's, you know, 164K ought to be enough for anybody. Can you imagine having 164K of memory? No. And then there's, who is it, the founder of DEC who said, a personal computer in your home? That'll never happen. Yeah. So, right, guys, steam engines are another one of my favorite examples. Steam engines were used for 30 or 40 years as essentially glorified water pumps before somebody came along and had the bright idea of building a locomotive and putting something on a track. Computers, right, Thomas Watson Sr., who was the founder of IBM, said in about 1952 or three, I think there's a world market for about three computers. Because at the time, they were just giant calculating machines. The Army was using them to calculate trajectories for artillery shells. Pretty exciting. The internet was invented where?
People say UCLA.
Yeah, UCLA was one of the nodes there. Nobody said Al Gore's basement or something, right? Al Gore said he invented the internet. And recombinant DNA, I think, is another interesting example where people really didn't understand or recognize the potential of it. So it's not always obvious, and it's something that you need to be thinking about. So I've used this word a couple times, technology push. What is it? Technology push is when you're creating an entirely new market, okay? People don't know that they needed a product until it's there. So who can give me some examples of technology push? Things that you use.
Some of you are using them right in this room right now.
Cell phones? I think cell phones are actually a little bit more market pull. I mean, I was just at a conference on clean technology, and this guy was talking about technology trends, and he pulled up an issue of Ladies Home Journal from like September 1900, and it was predictions of what would the next 100 years bring. And actually, wireless telephones were predicted. Yeah, but did anybody ever really think they needed a camera phone? Right, I never did. Right, I mean, I think that's technology push. It was just like, oh, it's digital. What can we throw in there to, you know, kind of put more features in there?
I was just thinking like highlighters or Post-it notes. Like, you don't really feel like.
Post-it notes are a great one, right? nobody realized that they needed a Post-it note until they came along, and now there's right. How far would Walter DeLogie get without Post-it notes, right? Chairman of my company, Post-it maniac.
What else?
Sure.
iPods.
iPods is one of mine. I put it up there. I put it as a question mark because you did have, dating myself a little bit, you did have the Sony Walkman a long time ago before you had iPods. So that was up there. And some other examples, these are getting kind of dated. Betamax, you guys are, that was probably before you were born. You said VHS for VCR machines. Was it going to be VHS or Betamax? Sony made Betamax and tried to establish it as the standard. Didn't work. Does anybody remember laser discs? Remember those? They're like these big honking things. Yeah. Okay. Anyways. Market pull, of course, is... it's usually more an incremental improvement in quality. Now, sometimes not so incremental, but the market pulls the technology into it, right? And there's a need that exists, but there's no technology to meet the need. I see a GUI interface as a great example of market pull, right? Computers, you know, were out there, but they were just bumping along because nobody wanted to learn MS-DOS, right? It was just kludgy and awkward and right? And boom, there you go. And so these are some examples I put up there. Other examples that people can think of sort of market pull? Sure.
Microwave work?
Microwave, yeah, and it's sort of its second iteration. Microwaves, when they were first introduced, it was the Amana radar range, they called it. And it actually turned people off. They actually thought that the microwaves were going to do something bad to their food. So it's, anyway, I mean, this was 40, 50 years ago, 40 years anyways, and it's kind of nostalgic when you look at some of these people who are, you know, get all up in arms about genetically modified food. They think there's something, the food has somehow been altered and they're going to eat it and grow horns or something. People felt the same way about early days of microwaves, but sort of the second iteration around, they got it right. Any other examples? Yeah. Hybrid cars, I think, are a great, great example. Yep. I'm going to use that one. Thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
Could certain types of food, like, for example, Easy Mac.
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's a good one. Convenience, right? Market's all about convenience. You see that in the food industry a lot, right? Food industry is all about packaging and convenience and single servings and all kinds of stuff. So maybe not the most technically complex things, but nonetheless, they're there. Okay, so because so many biotech companies are in fact involved in pharmaceuticals, let me give you a little background on pharmaceutical product development and just kind of run through it quickly. You can really break it out into two or three phases. There's sort of R&D, research and development, where you're screening things, doing some preliminary tox work, some preliminary animal studies. And then you go through something called the preclinical phase, where you're looking at process chemistry, toxicology, a clinical plan, and then you file an IND, an investigational new drug. And then I'll go through this in a little bit more detail. You go through a clinical trial phase. Let me see. Let's skip ahead here for a second. Yeah. Where phase one, phase two, phase three, and if successful, you can file a new drug application, get that approved by the FDA, and sell a drug on the market. Phase one is basically testing the drug in normal human volunteers, read medical students. Phase two is a dose-ranging study in people afflicted with the disease. And then phase three is usually a large-scale, double-blinded, placebo-controlled study in people with the disease to show that the drug has a statistically significant impact on the disease state. Okay? What it takes is a lot of time and money. And so you can see that, roughly speaking, the whole process can take at least 10 years, and boy, these numbers are getting a little bit dated. It's at least $100 million. And what I would point out to you, and by the way, these numbers are getting bigger. I need to update these slides. The money is back-end loaded, right? You still spend money even though you've been at it for a good 7-8 years. And your chance of success is still pretty risky. Still pretty risky out here, right? Compared to what the way investors, certainly public market investors on Wall Street, the way their funds are structured, and I'll talk about that more in a second, they're not accustomed to taking that kind of risk. So where are we going to get the money to do this? Well, you can get money from revenue, but that's sort of a chicken and egg, right? If I had revenue, I wouldn't need... I would already have products. If I don't already have products on the market, I don't have revenue. You could go to the banks, right? But banks in the United States, they're going to want something called collateral, right? If you go to the bank for a loan, they're going to want, chances are, your father's signature, right? Or your mom's signature, and write something, you know, like something called collateral, so that if you don't show back up with the money, they can go collect it from somewhere. We have something in the United States called SBIRs. They're called Small Business Innovation and Research Grants, but they're typically pretty small. They're only about $100,000 or so, which sounds like a lot of money, but as you probably saw from the case study, you can go through $100,000 pretty quick when you don't have any revenues coming in. We also have in the United States a group of investors that are typically referred to as angel investors, and they are typically successful entrepreneurs who then back other entrepreneurs. They are not regarded as institutional investors, but rather individuals, wealthy individuals. We do have a very healthy and thriving venture capital industry here in the United States. And I'll talk more about what venture capital is and how it works. And then, of course, the other source of funding is what I call the three Fs, which is always friends, family, and fools. So what is venture capital? Venture capital is unsecured equity investing, right? So if I'm the venture capitalist and Bob's got the Rumpelstiltskin gene and he wants to start a company, he comes to me for $1 million, what I'm going to get for my $1 million is stock in Rumpelstiltskin Co., right? I'm not going to ask for a second mortgage on Bob's house, okay? I'm going to get stock, and what I'm going to generate my return when Rumpelstiltskin Co. goes public or it gets acquired, and then I'm going to sell my stock, hopefully, for some multiple of what I paid for it. So one thing you can learn about venture capitalists is that they think of their returns in terms of multiples, okay? They don't think about, oh, I'm going to make 5% or 10% or 50%, right? That's the way sort of a bank would structure a home loan or something like that. Venture capitalists think, I'm going to make 5 times, 10 times my money. Okay? And the reason that they think that way is because not everything works. Okay? There's a now famous venture capital firm called Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers, KPCB. You guys can go to their website and take a look at the names of some of the companies that they've founded. Okay? And their very first fund, Kleiner Perkins One, back in the 70s, invested in 13 companies. 11 of which you've never heard of. And the other two were Genentech and Apple Computer. And they were founding investors in Amazon, they were founding investors in Sierra and Juniper Networks, and they did... they weren't in FedEx, they were in Google, they were in, I mean, some real household names. Yeah, question. I can hear everybody. Can you not hear everybody? Oh, you're taping it. Okay.
Webcasting.
Where do the venture capitalist companies get their money?
Where do they get their money? Good question. Well, I'll just keep. They get it from other institutional investors. One of the biggest sources of institutional money, I'll give you two examples, actually. One is called CalPERS. Anybody know what CalPERS is? California Public Employee Retirement System. Right? So every time Bob Goldberg gets a paycheck... You're not in the CalPERS system? UCLA professors are not in it?
They're in the University of California Retirement System.
Ah, okay. So
state professors are in CalPERS.
Oh, there's state professors are in CalPERS. Okay, so if you're a state employee in the state of California, right, you have money deducted from your paycheck, goes into a pension fund, ultimately to pay for your retirement. It's a huge pool of capital. So if you're an investment officer at CalPERS, you've got to then go invest that money because you've got to pay for people's pensions 30 years down the road. So... they allocate that, right? They sit there and, I've got $100 billion or whatever it is that I have, and I've got to take some of it, I'm going to go buy treasury bonds, and some of it I'm going to invest in foreign capital, and some of it I'm going to, God knows, they might even go buy GM stock for all I know, right? But then some portion of it they're going to say, I'm going to do private equity, and I'm going to go invest in a fund, and I'll go invest in Kleiner Perkins or Oxford Bioscience Partners or something like that. So that's where it comes from. Another place people have been active in alternative investing is university endowments. So Stanford University has been very aggressive in investing its endowment in what they call alternative investments, of which venture capital would be one, and they're generating some fantastic returns. So generally speaking, venture capitalists, they're financing new, hopefully rapidly growing companies. They're purchasing equity, which is stock, right? They like to believe that they assist in the development of new products and services, but generally speaking, that's up to the senior management team. They take higher risks, okay? They take higher risks, but in the anticipation of higher rewards, okay? And so sometimes entrepreneurs don't like the idea that venture capital guys come in and offer a price that the entrepreneur feels is too low, because the venture capitalist wants to make his return. And of course, you say, well, the winners have to pay for the losers, and the entrepreneur says, well, I don't want to have to pay for the losers. Well, too bad. You have to. That's just the way the marketplace is going to work. Venture capitalists have a long-term orientation, but generally speaking, the funds that they set up as 10-year limited partnerships. So when I go to CalPERS or I go to Stanford University, I say, okay, give me $20 million today. but I'm going to give it back to you no later than 10 years from now. And so what that means is that in a 10-year life cycle of a fund, they need to be investing like crazy in the first 2 to 3 years, right? Giving the companies 2, 3, 4 years to mature and then be getting back out of them either through IPOs or acquisitions of the companies. And the big question has been, does this necessarily fit product development, biotech product development timelines? Because they themselves can be at least 10 years. And so that's one of the challenges in biotech investing. Just some quick sort of financial accounting type stuff. These are easy concepts. What is market capitalization? Market capitalization is just the value of a company, right? What is a company worth, right? And for a publicly held company, and you can go to NASDAQ.com or open the Wall Street Journal and find out the market cap of a company pretty easily. It's simply the number of shares issued by a company, right? Usually called issued and outstanding, times the price per share, right? So if I've got 1 million shares outstanding and my price today was $7 a share, that company is worth $7 million, right? Just not that hard. If we need to start this biotech company and we need $100 million plus to get there, typically speaking, right, if I'm Joshua Crane and I'm sitting at my kitchen table in Cambridge, Massachusetts, nobody's going to cut me a $100 million check, right? They're going to cut me a $2, $3, $4 million check and ask me to make some progress, okay? And so the financing life cycles of biotech companies, a lot of other companies, typically you have some seed capital, and I'm going to go through each one of these rounds. I might as well just do it. Let's not worry about that right now. Let's not worry about that either. So the seed stage is really, you know, let's write a business plan, let's license the technology, and all the stuff that Josh Crane is doing, and maybe attract some angel investors or, you know, a specialized firm that's interested in the technology that I'm developing. But it's not a lot of money, right? It's what was his name, Uncle Ernest had. It's less than $1 million. Then you go to this startup or first round, and that range typically is $1 to $10 million. And there's when you're really going to bring in, quote unquote, professional or institutional investors. And with that, you're going to, right, Josh is going to need more people than just himself, right? So he's going to have to hire in some other members of the management team. He's going to have a facility to do this stuff, and he's going to have to really kick product development in the pants down the road towards commercialization. And one of the questions people always ask is, well, how do I know what Josh's company is worth? How does Josh know what his company is worth? How does a venture capitalist know how much he should pay for Josh's company? How do you know? People used to ask me, is there like some magic formula, you know, sine, cosine, derivative, how you're going to come up with this? How do you determine the value of anything? Loda, how do you determine the value of anything? You want to sell your car. How do you know what it's worth?
You could look at the value of comparable models.
Comparables. How do comparables get established?
They're already in existence.
They're already in existence. Why? Because people are doing what? Buying and selling. So buying and selling is a market. So the market establishes the price, right? How do you know what your house is worth? Put up a for sale sign. See what somebody's going to offer you for it, right? Same thing with a startup company, okay? Generally speaking, there's always been there's usually more entrepreneurs chasing venture capitalists than the other way around. But we've seen that role get reversed. And the last time I saw it was in what we call the dot-com or dot-bomb days, right, where all of a sudden everybody had an idea about how to start an internet company and dot-com this and pets.com and this.com and that.com. And some people were making outrageous returns. And what happened was because entrepreneurs had 3, 4, 5, 10 different venture capitalists, right, trying to buy shares in their company, the prices got bid up. Yeah? So the market determines the prices of companies. Important concept. You still need to do this product development, right? You're probably not even in the preclinical stage yet, and yet it's going to take more money. And so You need to raise more money. And the problem has been is that what is the, how do you know that you're getting closer to actually having a drug on the market? What is the milestone that you've gone to, right? These biotech companies, because the product development cycles are so long, they typically don't have revenues. So you can't just sit there and measure them by these traditional financial parameters. Okay, anybody know what a P-E ratio is? Right? Gloria does, right? Price-earnings ratio, right? If you've got earnings, then you can say, well, I think this class of companies is worth some multiple of earnings. So a P-E ratio of 10 says that company is worth 10 times its earnings, right? But you don't have any earnings, right? So what have you done if I've put my money in at $1 a share? You know, what have you as an entrepreneur done to think that Gloria should put her money in at $2 a share? Right? Because if she puts money in at $1 a share, she's going to make a better return than I am, right? So this is the central problem in biotechnology investment. What have you done? And how do you demonstrate that you've built value? Again, more money. God, does it stop, right? Mezzanine round. Typically, again, more money. At this point, most biotechnology companies have at least something in clinical trials. They've done a phase one trial. They're in phase two. But what's a phase one study prove? You didn't kill anybody, right? You've tested the drug in normal, healthy volunteers, right? Come on. You're going to pay $6 a share because I didn't kill anybody in a clinical trial? Yeah, maybe not. Finally, you get to a point where people say, look, we need to do these clinical trials, and they're expensive. We need to go public. And unlike venture capitalists, now you're going to go to a different pool of capital, right? You're going to go to mutual funds and other public institutional investors. Now, venture capitalists, their funds are structured to take risks, right? They're coming in at a low price, and their financial returns, the way that those get calculated, they can still make money even though 11 out of 13 things fail. Okay, they can go drill some pretty deep holes in the water and still get out of them. Your typical public market investor, right? These guys are thinking now in terms of percentages, right? If they have a stock that goes up 20% in a year, that's a four bagger. Are you kidding me? That's fantastic. So a lot of these public mutual funds, you know, some of you guys probably have some savings, or your parents do, and you're invested in public markets or mutual funds and things like that. I mean, my God, if you're making 20% in the public markets, that's fantastic, right? What's the S&P 500 up over the past year? Or what's NASDAQ up over the past year? They're flat, right? I mean, it's not 20%. So these guys, you know, the idea that here's the $100 million from the IPO, and I'm an institutional investor, mutual fund investor, and I'm going to put $10 million into this company, and then your drug fails? Because it's only got about a 1 in 5 chance of working? Where's my $10 million go? Because that stock goes from wherever it was to, right, some small fraction of what it was. So the problem has been is that these investors, these later stage investors, are being asked to take risk that they're not financially structured to take. Okay, and that's I'm just going to beat on this drum because it's a central problem in biotech investing. Let's talk a little bit about biotech business models. FIPCO, fully integrated pharmaceutical company, FIPCO. These are companies...
Richard, you can talk about the timelines of these different investments, you know, seed and typical...
I can go back through that. I mean, again, the VCs have about a 10-year lifespan. When you start going to the public market investors, these guys have a quarter-to-quarter mentality, right? So it's very different. There's a real dearth of institutional investors who can invest in later stages of product development, but who still have long investment horizons, but whose return hurdles are not as high as the venture capitalists. Okay? Just simply stated. So FIPCOs are fully integrated pharmaceutical companies. They're characterized by what I would call high risk, high return. Right? If Josh does his cancer chemotherapeutic company, this is what he's going after: high risk, high return. And when you look at And I just explained this. We used to call these things hockey sticks. They're people's revenue projections, right? You ask them for their business plan. You say, well, I'm not making anybody any money now, but boy, stick with me. And once I get through, that's supposed to say phase three. Once I get through phase three, boom, am I going to make a lot of money, right? Hockey stick. But the NPV, net present value, if you tried to calculate, well, what is that revenue stream worth today? Well, it's zero if the thing fails, right? It's just not worth anything. So it's high risk. And so, in case you didn't get it yet, the FIPCO business model requires too much cash from investors up front and puts a disproportionate risk on the later stage investors. And this has been a central problem in biotechnology. So what have people done? They've come up with a couple of other models. Let me just go back a second. They had the FIPCO model, and this was high risk, high return. And then people went out and they started a bunch of other companies, and I'm guilty. I started at least one of these companies, GeneLogic. And these are companies that are focused on providing services to pharmaceuticals. So people say, well, pharmaceuticals is still a very lucrative industry, and biotechnology is neat technology. And rather than trying to forward integrate and actually sell pharmaceuticals themselves, we're going to provide these quote-unquote high-value services to pharmaceuticals. And they were seen as being low risk, but as it turns out, they turned out to be low return. Okay? You're not putting a $1 billion drug on the market here. You're servicing the companies who are, and so the returns are not that great. What has really turned out over the years, and I'm talking about a time span of about 20 to 25 years, people have figured out that probably the best biotech business model is what we call these platform companies. Human Genome Sciences, Exelixis, Millennium is probably the best example, where you have a technology platform that is broad enough that you can sell applications of that technology to other pharmaceutical companies or other companies in general, while at the same time pursuing your own internal stuff. So you don't have to go raise all that money from investors, right? Because now you're getting revenue in from corporate partners, from pharmaceutical companies who want to use your technology, right? So let's just say, you know, okay, that we're Millennium. I wish I could remember all the deals they did, right? We're Millennium Pharmaceuticals. We've got this genomics technology that we think can help identify new drug targets and discover drugs better, smarter, faster, cheaper. And what we're going to do is we're going to call up Pfizer and we're going to say, you know, for $50 million over 5 years, we're going to let you use our technology platform to go discover Alzheimer's drugs, right? And then we're going to call up Merck and we're going to say, you know, for $50 million over 5 years, we're going to let you use our technology to go discover cardiovascular drugs, right? All of a sudden, I've got $100 million in funding over 5 years, and I'm going to bootstrap that into developing my own antibiotics. Everybody with me? Okay. So what you can do is you sell this quote-unquote platform to multiple customers while still pursuing forward integration. You don't give up on having your own billion-dollar drug on the market someday. So it turns out to be low risk, high return. And when we look at the platform hockey stick, because you have many, many different ways to win, right, the NPVs actually look more attractive than an NPV that could quite possibly be zero because it's so high risk. So what makes biotech so expensive? I think I've communicated this to you, that it's these incredibly long product development cycles, right? It takes 10 years. And during that 10 years, right, Joshua is going to want to collect a salary, and so is his management team, right? You got to pay lawyers, you got to pay auditors, you're going to pay for preclinical testing services. You pay a lot of money for data management in clinical trials. And so a lot of money gets spent. Regulatory hurdles are high, right? The FDA is... The FDA has a public safety mission, and so they are incented not so much to approve new drugs, but to make sure that they don't approve bad drugs. And so they raise the hurdle pretty high.
Nick?
Question? Yeah.
Are there any services that are provided, like they got to pay for lawyers and... that do it for equity?
Yeah, interesting that you say so. Interesting question. So there are some venture capital firms that actually hire their own attorneys, their own in-house attorneys, their own in-house auditors, and their own in-house executive recruiters. and they then pay those guys to just work for their portfolio companies. So one of the things, if I go to that one of those particular venture capitalists and take their money, I'm going to get those other services from them.
Is that a recent development?
Yeah. I mean, recent, you know, over the past decade sort of thing. So let's talk about alternative products industries for biotechnology. You guys talk about this much at all? Agriculture, energy, well, okay. Well, let's skip over that then because you're going to get to it, and I want to get to the case study. So I think this is my last slide. So in order to start a biotechnology company, you have to do all the things entrepreneurs have to do, right? Recognize a market opportunity, recognize the potential of technology, right? Hire the right people, all of that stuff. But you also have to manage this product development risk, right? Because it takes so long. It's not like high tech or software where, yeah, I'm going to beta a product in the next 12 months and investors are going to see, does it work, does it not work, right? It's a long, I call it a sermon sell, right? It's a long, long process of preaching to the investment community, be patient, it's going to work, it's going to work, it's going to work. And all the while, you need to be raising money to fund it. So it's a unique challenge for biotechnology to be able to do these things. That's the end of my presentation. We're going to go to the case study. Questions? Comments?
Does anyone have any questions?
Criticisms?
For Richard. Radina.
Radina.
I was just wondering, in terms of the platforms.
Yeah.
Do these companies get to decide what the pharmaceutical companies will use their technologies for or no?
Generally speaking, yeah. So it's a negotiation.
Like a grant where a researcher says, I want to research this, can you give me the money? It's like the same thing.
Yep.
Ms. Zale.
I also had a question about that. When it's said that they sell the platform to multiple customers,
yep.
How do patents work in that? Do they also sell the patent, or do they keep that?
They license the patent. So they provide you, they will provide that customer a license, and they will allow that licensee to practice that invention, but only in a particular field, the field of Alzheimer's therapeutics versus cardiovascular therapeutics.
Betty.
So we talked about how like investors take risk when they put money into the business, but they can fall back because on the funds that they have so much of. But as a person who started, like the entrepreneur himself, like does he have a safety net, or like does the government help him, or is it just all out?
Nope. No safety nets. A couple comments on that. Entrepreneurs, are, in many respects, are risking their most valuable asset. They're risking their time, right? I've spent 10 years building this company, Cirrus, right? It's a big chunk of my adult professional business career, whatever you want to call it. So that's when I look at the risk that I've taken in Cirrus, it's more the time commitment to it than anything else. I think the other thing that's unique about the United States is that certainly venture capitalists will still back quote-unquote failed entrepreneurs, right? Just because you went out and started a company and it wasn't a huge success doesn't mean that people won't back you again. In fact, it's looked at it's not as positive as if you were successful, but the experience is regarded as useful.
Karina. Look at DeLorean.
Hmm?
DeLorean.
Yeah, I mean, you can find lots of examples of entrepreneurs who failed, and then, right, Ross Perot.
I had a question. About patents. You said that it creates like a temporary monopoly, but someday, I guess, my question is the company that has the patent is going to become very successful mm-hmm. in whatever they're producing, and why would they give up that patent and to the public, or how can the public compete with them once they've like mastered that product?
Well, companies go on to compete all the time, right? I mean, once upon a time, there was this little tiny startup car company called Toyota, right, out to compete with GM and Ford, who were, GM was probably one of the biggest companies in the world at that point. This was immediately post-World War II, and now Toyota is poised, or already is, the world's biggest car company. So those inventions go into the public domain when the patent expires. There's some things that companies don't ever want to go into the public domain, and so they don't patent them. They keep them as trade secrets, right? Coca-Cola's formula is one example. Anybody else think of other trade secret? That's always my favorite example of a trade secret. But question?
No.
Comment? Silly putty, probably. Another trade secret. You see it more. Seems in the ingredient business more than technology, but.
Karina, we're going to spend 2 weeks on this. You're going to be so tired of patents, you're not even going to want to hear about them anymore. We're a little ahead of the game here.
Yeah, Nicholas.
I had a question. As far as it seems like FDA, as far as where is the regulatory thing, is what they're trying to get by. Is there like way you can check up on statuses, like as far as how far a company is along that path? So like you said, you know, once they get past that, it's like, you know, printing their own money.
Yeah,
it's all like behind.
There's not really a centralized database of it, but companies themselves generally shout it from the highest rooftop. Because biotech companies certainly want you to know. Pharmaceutical companies typically keep that information to themselves. They don't want their competitors to know where they're having success and where they're not. And so pharmaceutical companies will typically only let you know much later in the game where things go. Betty.
For the information you told us about, did you learn that like with their PhD, or did you learn that after you went into the business? Like, would it help if we learned business in college too?
Everything that I talked to you about today, I learned sort of in the venture capital world, not so much in my academic work getting a PhD. So, Ben?
I just wanted to know, when you patent a DNA sequence,
yes,
what if someone else has a different sequence that codes for the same protein? Do that.
Yeah.
Good question, Ben.
Yeah. So
Very good question.
At Ceres, I call it the Kentucky bluegrass scenario. So if I find a valuable gene in corn, I find the Rumpelstiltskin gene in corn, how do you prevent somebody from coming along and finding the same gene in Kentucky bluegrass? And it's what? It's not, you have to adequately describe your invention such that you would cover that other DNA sequence. So, right, these guys have enough molecular biology. Okay, so you can go through and you claim a DNA sequence, but then certainly for our patent applications, we claim the underlying protein sequence, right? So you immediately get around the wobble of the third base. Then we go through and we look at every conservative amino acid sequence change we could make, substituting lysine for arginine or something like that.
Degeneracy in the code.
Right? Well, the code degeneracy is one thing, but that's the primary sequence. Now you talk about secondary protein structure of just changing out conservative amino acids, right? And looking, well, if that's an alpha helix, I'm going to claim all the amino acids which would maintain that alpha helix. I'm not going to claim a proline in the middle of there or something like that, right? And then to the extent you can try and claim the tertiary structure. And the best thing to do, and our intellectual property strategy, is for every gene that we have, we want to have as many homologs and orthologs as we can. So we sequence like crazy.
Means small biotechnology company, large patent law firm.
Large patent expenses. Our patent expenses are about 10% of our annual run rate. Yeah.
So say that an entrepreneur is successful in getting a venture capitalist firm to invest in his company.
Mm-hmm.
Where does the entrepreneur gain? I mean, if the venture capitalists own all the stocks,
They don't own all of it. So if I'm typically, what happens is the entrepreneurs are going to own something called common stock. Okay, so if I am starting this company and let's just use Joshua for example, the VCs that are going to come in and invest $1 million. They're not going to own 100% of his company for that first $1 million. They might own 50% of it, but he's still going to own the other 50%. So he owns something called common stock. venture capitalists typically say, take something called preferred stock, which is preferred on the basis of a couple things. One, it has a, what's called a liquidation preference. So if the company gets sold, they're in line first to get their money back before the common stockholders get anything. And there's a lot of bells and whistles here that we could spend all day talking about. They also typically have something called anti-dilution protection, which is if somebody comes along and then pays a lower price than them, their stock gets converted down partially or fully to that lower price. So it's not in the entrepreneur's interest to see a lower round get done because they get diluted out then. But that's where the entrepreneurs make their money. They then own that common stock. Now, the other thing that's typical in startup companies, regardless of whether you were the entrepreneur or something, is for my company, every employee at Cirrus gets something called common stock options. Okay, so they get an option to purchase common stock in the company. And it's an option that's good for 10 years. They don't have to exercise it, right? They can wait and see if the company is successful and if the stock is quote-unquote liquid. In other words, is it publicly traded or has the company been acquired so that they can actually take those shares and go get money for it. Then they can exercise that option, they're issued a share, and they can turn around and sell it. And that's very common practice in the United States in high-tech companies. A lot of Microsoft millionaires, right, of people who could have been secretaries at Microsoft or Google or whatever, and they got, you know, a couple thousand shares, you know, options to purchase a couple thousand shares, and then the stock went to 100 and split three times on the way or something. So, yes, sir.
Who really do they test the phase one on? I mean, who are the actual people?
Medical students.
It really is medical
volunteers.
Students. So it's just, even though this could like have horrendous like side effects, they...
No, it's been tested. The FDA is going to require you to test it in two different animal models before you go into people. So, I mean, PETA doesn't like that.
Right.
But that's different. So... Yeah, I wouldn't sign up for something that hadn't been tested in at least one animal model. Yeah.
For the patent firms, it seems like they would need to have some kind of extensive molecular biology background. So they have like experts in house or some of their lawyers like have like, you know, dual
PhDs.
Degrees.
Yep. Exactly that. Yeah, I mean it sounds like they're professional students or something, but there's no shortage of sort of PhD JDs in the world. People with backgrounds, you know, doctorates in molecular biology and then go to law school at night, work in law firms.
There's a bunch of those?
the big IP, Fish and Richardson, they have, I should say there's lots, but they probably have a dozen of people like that.
You can't be a patent lawyer unless you have a degree in a science. It's a requirement. So you must have either a bachelor's, a master's, or a PhD in some science in order to be a patent lawyer.
Is that true? I didn't know that. See, I learned something today. Anybody? We're going to take that picosecond break now?
Any other questions?
We're going to talk about the case study. I'm not going anywhere.
Brian, you happy? One thing I want to just add, and then we'll take a break, and that is coming back, Karina, to your question, and a couple of you on patents, and Richard said it, and we're going to talk more about it, but the patent is a compact between society and the company, and the society gives the company a monopoly for 20 years to exclude others from practicing their invention, and at the end of 20 years, it turns over to society, so it's a compact. And at the end of that 20 years, anybody can practice that invention. And there's very specific requirements that we'll go into. But you commonly use this kind of process in things called generic drugs, which are off-patent, of which now many different companies can synthesize the same drug and sell it to you. But while it's on patent, they can't do that. Any other questions? Let's take a... 43.2 nanosecond break and come back in 7 minutes at exactly 5 o'clock. Jessica, see if Richard needs anything like coffee or Coke or whatever.
We have a full buffet outside if you'd like some.
A full buffet, huh?
It's there already?
Hungry? Yeah.
Well, if you guys want to, we want to open it up or wait?
Let's wait till afterwards.
Okay, we'll wait. Is it covered and everything? But maybe Richard wants something.
Yes, exactly. What would you like? Coffee, tea, iced tea?
I'm fine. I just drink my water.
Vegetables, egg rolls.
I'll wait.
Fruit. Okay. Strawberries are really good, everybody.
Hi.
My father's an ophthalmologist, and he also has an MBA. And he's invented a belt that prevents refraction in elderly people when they fall exposed to an air pollution epidemic. 60,000 people are dying in the U.S. 20-30 million falls every year.
Great.
I know it's not biomedical, but I thought maybe if you have a car that guys would be in touch, it might be an issue.
Sure. I mean, I could just hook him up with some VCs.
Yeah.
Have, so.
Excellent.
Yep.
Kids are, you know, French majors and dance majors.
Yeah.
To be a little louder for his microphone. I'm trying to get his audio.
You want me to crank it up?
No, don't crank it up. Just maybe.
Up in the collar?
Yeah. See if we can sound coming through. Yeah, the webcasts are good.
Like, I've got time for that.
Huh?
Like, I've got time for that. Good Lord. What's the occasion? I'm the occasion. This is how your tuition dollars get spent?
Exactly. This is how,
no, this is how the
money gets
right,
spent.
This is how the grant money gets spent.
Oh.
Howard Hughes would be very proud.
Oh, did they just build this building?
Yeah, brand new.
Wow. So when are they going to name a building after you? Did they name this one after you?
Yeah. You have to be
dead first?
No, you've got to give money. You can have any building you want named after you. It's just for a price.
$10 million.
$1 million for a room, $10 million for a building for 5 years, $100 million. It's time.
You've been here a long time. Were you like one of the original professors at UCLA?
I've got so many original names in the halls they took down. Like the original.
They took them down so that somebody could pay for them again. It's like naming stadiums.
Exactly. I hate that. It's like Kinsey Hall, one of the first buildings on campus. They took the name away because someone gave them $50 million.
Let's not name it after good professors. Let's just name it after.
Well, the next step is McDonald's.
Dead rich guys.
In-N-Out Burger Hall
of Oregon. Okay, so you gotta help me with this Q&A and get them going. It's one thing to. It's one thing for me to instead of lecture. Yeah. No worries. You need to plug it in. It's over here. Thank you. that the?
Yeah, regulate.
Let me see the questions. I have a different set. The Assistant Secretary General. Tonight? No, I'm meeting a former Under Secretary of State.
Oh, okay.
It's okay.
Wait, so what do you... So that's not... That's a form, so you're not doing anything current administration?
With the current government? I am, but not tonight. Energy, biomass, and biofuels. Energy, very interesting area. Well, certainly energy security is a big issue for the United States today. Right, we import most of our oil, and if we could grow some of it domestically, that would be pretty important. Ready to get going? Okay, so how many of you guys have ever taken a class that was taught by the case study method? Anybody, any undergraduate classes get taught by the case study method at UCLA? Anybody know what I'm talking about when I say the case study method? Yes, you do. So if you go to Harvard Business School, everything gets taught in case studies. And you read cases every night, much like the one that I wrote. I hope you liked it. I wrote it last weekend. It's just sort of off the top of my head. Just, you know, and they're generally, the Harvard Business School case studies are often based on real companies, and then the names are changed. Names of the company and the names of the individuals are changed, but they're usually actual companies. The case study that I generated was just completely made up out of my own imagination. And So what happens is when you go to class, and there are classrooms that look just like this, maybe a little bit bigger, you may get picked on, you may not, but if you get picked on, you should know, right, the details of the case. You should know that you've read it and thought about it. So that's what we're going to try and do. I don't teach for a living, but Bob does. He's going to help me out in making sure we get a dynamic going here. So
did you tell that little joke about Bruins are forever?
They know that joke.
They don't.
They know that joke.
You tell them what you did to me in front of the chancellor and everything with that joke? Richard.
Do we really want to tell that story now, Bob?
Yeah. So this
is your Blue Shield dinner? Was that what it was for?
Yeah, for the Academy. This was the National Academy.
It was the National Academy dinner?
Yeah.
It wasn't the Blue Shield dinner?
No, National Academy.
All right. So you invited me to this dinner, and it was Fred.
The Chancellor.
Fred
and
Brian.
That fancy place.
Yeah. I don't get too impressed with these academic types. But anyway, so we're there with the dean and the chancellor, and everybody has to stand up and say something nice about Bob, and then it became my turn, and I had to think for a little while to come up with something nice about Bob, and I said that Bob was a very dedicated scientist, and that was why he had gotten to the National Academy, but that he was also very dedicated to UCLA, and I was teasing him earlier that he doesn't have a building named after him yet. And that I said, what did I say? I said that, yeah, if you nicked one of Bob's veins, he would bleed Bruin blue. And then I reminded everybody at the table that a Bruin was forever, but Trojan's only good once. So let's talk about Joshua Crane. So who wants, wait a second, let me ask you this, who wants to be rich? A lot of people want to be rich. Who wants to be, like, really rich? Really rich.
Look at Gloria. Okay. My God. Show me the money.
Okay, so if you want to be rich, raise your hand again. Just go. Don't be shy. I'm a venture capitalist. Getting rich, good thing to me. Now keep them up if you want to be an entrepreneur. Right.
You guys aren't going to get rich.
Yeah. So who is it that you're going to go work for? I'd love to have your job. Who are you going to go work for that's going to make you rich? You can be in the Lucky Sperm Club, right, and just inherit it, but maybe not. Yeah, it hasn't worked out for me so far. So if you go take a look at the Forbes 400, the 400 wealthiest individuals in the world, and ask what kind of people they are, and you will find, more often than not, they are entrepreneurs. Bill Gates is an entrepreneur. Steve Jobs is an entrepreneur. Ross Perot, entrepreneur. Vinod Khosla, anybody know Vinod Khosla? Founder of Sun Microsystems. Vinod.
Stephen Dill.
Entrepreneur. So entrepreneurs are, I think, well, I am one, so I think they're great. They're all tall, dark, handsome, and intelligent. Pick two.
Okay, let's do the case study. So... T, why don't you come down to the front of the room and give us the facts of the case? You can stay there if you want. Give us the facts of the case and about, just summarize what the situation is.
Well, Joshua Crane,
don't talk to me, but...
Okay, so there's this guy named Joshua Crane, and... he discovered these two things, the automated DNA sequencing, and then the other one was for cancer or whatever. And so he wants to start area of cancer chemotherapeutics.
And what was he working on? What kind of chemical?
For the cancer one?
Well, for both.
Oh, well, he was working with the synthetic nucleotides.
Synthetic
nucleotide is,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
I hope so.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and he wants to stall the cancer and then stuff like that. But he wants to start a company and to put these two things together to produce products.
So you want to put them together or separate?
Not together, but he wants to make a company that uses those right. two techniques.
So what I was trying to do when I wrote the case is Josh has a little bit of a technology platform here, if you will, right? He's got a set of synthetic nucleotide chemistry, right, for which he could do a couple of different things, right? He doesn't have 10 different things to go do. He can kind of go one of two directions, and that's his quandary, right? Which way should he go and why?
Yeah, that was actually a problem with his like plan that he
So presented. Let's finish the case too.
Yeah.
So okay. He has these nucleotides. Where did he work on those nucleotides? In the company or where?
Oh, what in his work.
Where was he?
Where was he?
Let me see.
Daisy?
He had a fellowship, I think, at a university. And he had, when he started his company, maybe 9 months left.
But where did he do the research? Where was the technology developed? In the company or in the university? Charles?
I think it was in the university at Whitehead.
You think?
It was.
Okay. Whitehead Institute, MIT. MIT. Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
So we have the technology, T. What's the technology?
The DNA.
I'll say it. Go ahead.
But
what is the chemistry that he's working on?
Synthetic nucleotides. The synthetic nucleotides.
Synthetic nucleotides. And what areas he want to go into?
Entrepreneurship.
No, but what does he want to do with his synthetic nucleotides?
Oh, he wants to use it.
Well, the applications. What are the applications that he wants to pursue? You said one of them. You said them both, but it's...
Okay, so he wants to do the desktop automated sequencing. Yeah. And then the cancer chemotherapy.
Cancer chemotherapeutics. Because the human genome has been sequenced.
Yes.
Right? There's all this DNA information out there, and all of a sudden, right, you're going to go to your doctor's office, and you're going to get your DNA sequenced and see what's wrong with you. Yes.
Okay, so Kyle, he's got these nucleotides that are pretty nifty. Worked on them when he was a fellow at MIT at the Whitehead Institute. Thinks he has some pretty, you know, earth-shattering applications. Doesn't want to go and become a professor at Northeastern University. He thinks he might want to start a company and commercialize it. What did he do?
He looked for startup capital. He needed to, in order to get it, he needed to create a, he needed the money in order to draw up legal documents and patents and...
Where did he get his cash from?
From
what was it? What did Richard say it was? Where did he get his capital from?
From his uncle.
And the three Fs.
Oh.
Friends, family, and fools. Yeah. Right. That was one of the sources of venture capital, right?
His uncle. But Uncle Ernest isn't really just a fool, is he? He's also a what? He's a successful entrepreneur in his own right. So he's also an angel investor, which is what I intended him to be. Not so much the three Fs. Okay. So, nobody wants to be Josh. Nobody, she does.
Daisy
does. So,
give Daisy the microphone.
So here's Joshua. He spent, so just to explain to you, so you go, you get a PhD, you know, 4, 5, 6 years to get a PhD, and then you go and do these postdoctoral fellowships. Generally, what, 2 to 3 years? Sometimes shorter, sometimes longer.
Sometimes 5, sometimes 6,
right.
Sometimes
and then
7.
So this is what he's been doing. He's been getting up, going to the laboratory, working on this stuff. Day in and day out, probably took him 3 years.
For 30 G's a year.
For the princely sum of about $30,000 a year. Who owns that? Who owns that? Who owns the rights to that technology? Does anybody think that's fair? Why?
Okay,
what does the university do?
Who says it's fair and who says it's not?
Well, they provide the resources. So,
what do they provide?
The labs, all the
is that my phone?
All the equipment he needs.
Is that your phone, Richard? It's not mine. It's yours. It's your kids, Richard.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Matt.
Anyways, I say they provide the resources, the labs, they surround them with other scientists.
They provide the resources.
They have other
provide the laboratories.
People that can advise him, possibly. I don't know exactly how it works.
Provide the accounting for the research grants, electricity for the buildings, garbage collectors, water, janitors, bathrooms, everything. Okay?
So let me ask you this. Where did the university get the money to build their beautiful laboratories and keep those lights on?
The endowment or the money they made from the
patents? They got some of it from the endowment.
From the money they made from discoveries that they could...
Yeah, some of it. The bulk of it comes from Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam pays for it. They get it from the federal government. And UCLA, right, Bob Goldberg gets... Yeah, well, my favorite topic. He wasn't going to tell you about it. Bob Goldberg gets a grant, right? And then the university will charge the government overhead. Right?
I'm going to talk about that.
Right? In order for Bob Goldberg to go spend his $100,000 a year, UCLA charges the government another $50,000 to keep the lights on and the janitor, et cetera, et cetera. So the government funds a lot of it, but Bay Dolak says university gets to own the technology. Okay? So Josh is going to go, and he's going to go to MIT. He's going to go to the licensing office, and he's going to want to get the rights to his technology. Okay? And there is, I don't know if it's sort of an unwritten rule. I don't know if it's a written rule at some universities, but the inventors are typically first in line to license the technology. I don't know.
Not at the University of California.
No? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily so. Some universities, a little bit different. But let me ask this question. How much do you think Josh should pay MIT for the rights to his discoveries? Right? He's got 100 grand from Uncle Ernest.
Let's ask it in a different way. You're the licensing technology officer of now MIT. What are you going to charge in order to give Josh exclusive rights to this technology?
Loda knows. What are you going to charge him?
What were the figures?
Didn't give you any figures. You going to make him pay cash?
No.
So what are you going to do? So what are you going to do?
What will the market bear? Right? Josh is not the only entrepreneur out there. There's hundreds of people. There's thousands of people like Josh. And if you sit there and say, hell, I want you to pay $50,000 and a 40% royalty to me, guess where that technology's going? Absolutely nowhere. Absolutely nowhere. So the licensing officer of the university is part of a technology market, just as a venture capitalist is. Right? And if all of a sudden he sees entrepreneurs that are willing to pay high upfront fees and high royalty fees, that's what he's going to get. If the technology is just going to sit there, he's going to let it go for a much lower price. It's what the market will bear. Okay? Do you think he should pay cash? Cash is king to Josh, right? He's only got $100,000. He's got a rent payment he needs to make. What else does he have to give up?
I didn't hear.
Time?
Maybe if it was from a university, what the university can do is that, they can basically have that researcher work there for a certain period of time in return for exclusive rights. No? It doesn't work that way?
It violates the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. No involuntary servitude.
He already works there. What else does he have? What else does he have? If he's successful.
Can he, if his company becomes successful, can he give back, shares of that company to the university so that they'll make money off of that?
Exactly. He can. So those are things he can get. He can give up equity.
The university could take some shares in his company. Or, Jordan, what else?
What if his hockey stick comes true? What does he have? What does he have out at the other end of that hockey stick? What does that hockey stick represent? It represents revenue. He can give them what?
Go ahead, Jordan.
money. Just
you can give them money. What do we typically call it? I mean, he's not going to give them all the money, though, is he?
No, just a certain percentage.
Percentage. What do you call that percentage?
Like in music industry, and you've heard of it.
It's a royalty. Yeah. You can give them a royalty, right? Royalties are good if you got them because you don't do anything for them, right? You just there's no cost of goods sold. There's no SG&A. Just print money, right? So you can give up royalties on his invention, and that's typically what happens, okay? At the university, they don't take a lot of equity ownership because the equity can ultimately not be worth anything. But if the product's successful, there will be royalties. And so Cohen Boyer, which is the patent on recombinant DNA technology, which it's now expired, what?
About a year or two ago.
It was only a year or two ago? Yeah. I thought it was more like five.
No, because it didn't let.
Right, but Stanford was making about, what, $40 million a year on that?
Was one of the biggest royalty earners in the University of California.
Yeah.
Shared between University of California and Stanford, but it was a flat fee, actually. It was a flat royalty. Anyone who used it only had to pay $10,000. Think about that.
Yeah.
Almost nothing. Company wanted to use recombinant DNA technology. They paid a flat royalty fee of $10,000. That's all, in order to use that technology. So it's sold pretty cheap.
So let's ask about Uncle Ernest, who's now actually put money in. What do you think Uncle Ernest should own? What is he going to get? Josh's firstborn male child? I don't know that I wrote one of those in. I think he had a daughter in the story or something, right? He's going to get equity. What kind of equity is he going to get? He's getting preferred stock. Are you kidding me? Right? So he's going to get preferred.
What was that preferred stock again, Daisy? What was the preferred stock?
Why is it preferred? Do you remember why preferred stock is preferred, typically?
If the company is going to be sold, they get
first in line,
dibs.
Liquidation preference.
Yeah.
And anti-dilution. Now, one of the things, just a quick tangent here, one of the things you typically saw, you sometimes see with these angel investors is these guys will actually put money in as debt, okay? Or they'll call convertible debt. Right? So the debt comes in, $100,000 of debt, and then it converts into preferred stock when the first institutional money comes in. And it'll convert at some rate slightly better than whatever the professional money comes in. So if you have a convertible debt at 80% of first series, right, and then the venture capitalists say come in at $1 a share, then the convertible debt converts into equity, converts into shares at say 80 cents. You see that sometimes, reasonable amount of time. Uncle Ernest, you know, how much of Joshua's company should Uncle Ernest own? Yeah, he's a family member, right? All of a sudden you can see where it gets a little dicey having family members invest in your company. For $100,000, he's certainly not going to own 50% of the company or anything like that. I would argue that he owns a much smaller percentage of that. Uncle Ernest will probably also get either what are called some stock options, okay? He'll probably be on the board of directors, he'll get some options. Or the other thing that you see startup companies give away, which is another form of equity, or something called warrants. And a warrant is a lot like a stock option, except a stock option is generally priced at a significant discount to the actual price of the preferred. Bob knows these debates well. Okay, so a stock option in Josh's company is probably going to be priced at about a 10-to-1 discount from the price of the preferred. So if the price of the preferred comes in at $1 a share, options are going to be at about 10 cents. A warrant goes for the same price as the preferred share. So you get, but you don't have to pay the money then. So you get a warrant to purchase stock at $1, but the warrant can be good for 10 years. And so if 10 years from now Josh's company is successful and it's worth $80 a share, and you've got a warrant at $1, it means you pay $1, get a share, turn around,
sell it for $80, make $79 like that. Let's talk about Josh's business plan. And they actually do have these business plan competitions at MIT, and there actually are panels of venture capitalists that judge the business plans. And I've actually sat on those panels to judge the business plans of nascent entrepreneurs. What was in Josh's business plan? What are the things that he described in trying to convince people to put capital into his company?
So let's have a Josh talk about it. Josh.
What are the elements that Josh put into his business plan? I put it in there somewhere.
Physical elements or intangible elements? I know you used a PowerPoint presentation, and I know...
Yeah, well, but in you know, what were like the chapters of his...
There's a sentence in there.
There's a sentence. He had an executive summary.
Executive summary, an overview of the
market opportunity.
And the technology. The commercialization plan.
Great, commercialization plan.
Financial projections.
Right, he had his own hockey stick in there. What's missing? You guys aren't even venture capitalists, but what's missing? What would you want to know? Give me two other things you would want to know before you put money into this company, into Josh's company. What do you want to know?
I don't know if that was included in there, but like what you can do with the technology or the applications of it.
Yeah, that's the technology, the market opportunity. Yeah.
How much they're going to make, like what percentage they're going to own?
It's in his financial projections. Yeah, Sam.
More specifically, what the business is going to focus on. And Rarit said it lacked focus.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a problem with Josh's plan, but that's, you know, that's the commercialization. Remember I put up that slide about entrepreneurs?
What's missing from this business plan?
They're not everyday walk of life people, right? They're not necessarily average. They're driven people. So what's missing?
What's missing from this business plan? Juditha?
Maybe like a broader indication of how his technology is going to affect change, or like it says like visions of change, visions of opportunity, like what that's going to be. No? Okay.
Sommer, show me the money.
You can wait a second. We're in L.A. Anybody know anybody in the movie business, entertainment industry? If you're a producer, you're going to back a movie. What do you want to see?
Nick,
you want
to see screenplay, a script. What else?
Well, I was going to say you want to know that it's going to be desired by the public, that there's a need for that.
Sure. What else do you want to know about, Ardina? You're going to produce this movie. You got a screenplay. You need.
Betty. Betty.
Actors. My goodness, you need people. There's no description in Josh's business plan about a management team.
Yeah, or like you can't have a class without you guys.
Right? There's an old venture capital saw that says, always invest in A people with B ideas and not B people with A ideas. Okay?
Listen to that again. Say it again, Richard.
Always invest in A people with B ideas, not B people with A ideas. Okay? So the single most important decision a venture capitalist makes is, who am I investing in? Because I'm going to put this money in, and I'm going to go away. I'm going to show up to board meetings once a quarter. I'm going to talk to Josh on the phone in between. But boy, I better have some confidence in Josh and the management team that he puts together. And it's the single most important part of the business plan. And Josh doesn't have it in there at all. Okay?
So it's all about people.
So don't think that, you know, I stand up here and I've got a PhD in molecular biology and it's just, I'm just a better judge of technology and this, that, and the other thing. You had better be a pretty darn good judge of people. And you have to be able to project yourself as somebody who is worthwhile of investment. Okay? What else is Josh's business plan missing?
Jennifer. Not
How many kids had a lemonade stand when they were kids? Everybody tried that. Never really worked very well.
Kool-Aid.
Never did, really did for me. Imagine if it did, right? Imagine if it did, right? And all of a sudden you were making money hand over fist selling lemonade in the neighborhood. What do you think Jimmy down the street would do? You'd do the same. You'd have a competitor. There's no competitive analysis in Josh's plan. I'm just going to make a better mousetrap and the world's going to beat a path to my door. Not likely. Josh seems like a pretty shrewd guy. He's trying to make his money go as far as he can. He's got some licensing costs. He's got to pay attorneys. He's got these preclinical results. But he's got this buddy down the hall who's got these immunodeficient mice. Right? Sweet. Right? Cancer model set up, ready to go. What do you guys think? Go for it? Right, cheap, easy, fast. Get some results. See if these synthetic nucleotides shrink tumors, human tumors, in these mice. Good idea.
Where's his buddy work, Easter?
At a competing firm.
Where's his buddy work? Do you read the plan, Chris? Where's the buddy work?
Doesn't he work at a competing firm? He was an MIT postdoc, and now he works at some at a competing.
No, that was Tom Telling. This guy with the immunodeficient wife works down the hall.
Oh, then he works for the university and works the way. Thing.
So who's going to own the results?
University.
Got a problem there, huh?
Oh my God! Right here, I've got this promising compound. All of a sudden, it shows utility as a cancer drug, and I don't own the utility. Big mistake. Right. So you got to be thinking through these issues of technology ownership.
And who will be a co-inventor if something comes through with using the mouse model?
The buddy.
So therefore, how is the company going to use the results? So if you were Josh, where would you want to do the testing?
I don't know, with anybody with whom I had an agreement to... Outside of the university?
Yeah, exactly. You just said it.
So let's talk a little bit more, and just that I've got a few minutes remaining, and I go scoot. Let's talk about these applications that he's talked about. And, you know, so the human genome did, in fact, get sequenced several years ago, 5 years ago now. What do you guys think of this business, this desktop DNA sequencing business? Does it exist? Does it exist today?
Radina.
I think my question about that would be, if a venture capitalist can decide what research to fund, if like the cancer drug, it might be extremely helpful to people, but maybe they wouldn't make as much money in it as the other application. So what if they choose the other application with, you know, consequences for people who are dying in the meantime of cancer, like? Do they weigh this, or do they think of like where they're going to make more money, or
social
what's going to be more useful?
Social responsible investing. They think about their returns, right? And in thinking about their returns, they're in fact being socially responsible because they're deploying capital in the most efficient way. It's an economics lecture. We won't get into it right now, but let's focus on desktop DNA sequencing. Technology push, market pull.
Ben. Go ahead. I'll repeat it.
I would say more market pull.
Market pull.
A friend at Applied Biosystems, they even showed interest in licensing the technology.
Yeah, I probably didn't elaborate on this enough in the case. Applied Biosystems, their business is really making laboratory sequencers. Okay, that's for people like Bob working in a laboratory
or companies like Cirrus, we've got a bunch of automated sequencers. What Josh is really thinking about doing is desktop DNA sequencing, DNA sequencers that would be in your physician's office. Anybody been to the doctor lately? Anybody see any DNA sequencers? Right? So human genome's been sequenced for 5 years. What happened? How come I don't go and get a little pinprick of blood and get my DNA sequenced? See what's wrong with me.
Heather?
Over there with the microphone.
Nick? Yeah. I was going to say that, well, I mean, clearly that's not, you know, available on the market yet, or at least not a cheap enough price. But I think the article that he was alluding to is we read something about how they just recently came up with something in that technologically advanced it.
454.
So that you can do a
Life
lot
Sciences
more.
454.
Oh, 454, yeah. The sequencing by pyrolysis and then mass spec, yeah, sure. So you say, Nick, maybe it's a cost curve, right? Drive the technology costs down and sooner or later it'll be cheap enough and anybody can do it. So, but that's what I was trying to establish is that it was actually Josh's chemistry that might enable that, okay? That's what I was trying to get you to think about was that the technology that he was going to enable this drive down the cost curve. But what's missing still? What's missing? Why aren't physicians sequencing our DNA when we go to the doctor's office?
Heather? Betty? Because they don't know.
Because they're not going to do a damn thing with the information. They
exactly.
don't know what to do with it. Okay? So right now, today, right, who is going to develop, right, Josh is not in the business of developing the diagnostic tests that would link DNA sequence information with disease, and we have that. There's a lot of academic researchers here at UCLA and around the world that do that, but I got to tell you, even today, there's very few that will link a DNA diagnostic result with an impact on what a physician would call a clinical decision tree. Right? It's not going to impact the decision that the physician is going to make, so why does he need that test? You see it sometimes in prenatal testing, right? There, right, a DNA-based diagnosis will make an impact on the decision tree. Where are we going from here? But for many, many diseases, it's just not there yet. So to me, this is very much just technology push, right? It's neat technology, but the market isn't there yet. The market isn't saying, oh my God, I've got to have this DNA sequence information, therefore I need a technology that will allow me to get that sequence information in this particular clinical setting. I gotta get going. So the decisions, here's Josh, he's an entrepreneur, he's run out of money. If I ask myself the decisions that I would make, Applied Biosystems has an existing business, and they're interested in this technology. There, in that particular instance, it really is market pull. They want that incremental improvement in cost or quality or whatever it is that his synthetic nucleotides do. And by doing that, he's going to be able to do what? He's probably going to be able to generate either some licensing income or some royalties or some revenue in the near term, right? And he can use that, both that cash and then that credibility, to fund this, which is the development, right? Because this is the high risk, high return, and if he gets it, it's a $1 billion molecule. And that was the lesson that I wanted you to get from the class and the case. Questions, comments,
questions?
Confusion? Just all seems so simple, doesn't it? Okay, guys.
Let's give Richard a big applause. And there's handouts, but we have to get them this minute. Why don't we go outside and grab some of this food, and maybe Richard will spend a couple minutes if you have any specific questions, and then we'll come back in and get your handouts and everything and wrap everything up. Okay?
Yeah, I gotta see who called me.
What are we doing? No, I don't want you to come back. I'll take them out for the food. Then we'll come back in and clean up.
Cool. Dinner got canceled. My dinner got canceled. I'm going to have dinner with you guys.
Excellent.
Brilliant. And I don't have to get on the 405 at 5:30 in the evening, which would be like...
Are you coming to dinner?
Yeah, my phone call was...